I'm Glenn Hill.
And I'm Jacob Meyer.
And this is the Australian Open men's, I guess, semifinals review and then finals preview edition. Before we get to that, I guess, quick mention of the overnight results, Jacob.
Shout out to Serena getting to number 23 and to Pearson Continent getting to number one.
Right, that first one must be feeling pretty sweet right about now.
It was a hurdle for those guys.
For sure, for sure. So let's jump right into men's semis, and I guess we'll go in chronological order and deal with Federer, Wawrinka. I mean, first of all, how fantastic, two amazingly high-quality five-set matches to lead into the men's final, which I think just ties into this whole... The whole slam has just been so exciting. To me, the most exciting slam we've had in 10 years, maybe.
Can we just start there? Is this possibly the greatest Grand Slam of our generation right now?
You know, it's hard to argue against that. I mean, there's just so
individual
much
tournament.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just in terms of the overall, all the storylines. Like, there's just so many great stories taking place, and so many fantastic results, and yet here we are also still talking about Federer and Nadal in a final, which in a sense, and then also the Williams sisters. It's like we've come full circle. You know, we went through this whole era of very predictable Grand Slams in a sense where, you know, we went through a five-year period where it was basically one or two guys who was going to win everything. And then we've gone through this other five-year period where it was one of four guys who was going to win everything. And now, you know, here we are. Nobody's expecting those two guys to win everything anymore. Here they are in the final, and everybody else has fallen by the wayside. It's but not just that. I mean, like, there's just so many other things. I mean, you've got Dimitrov making his I guess arrival on the scene officially.
Well, he's playing the best tennis we've ever seen from him.
Oh, I mean, there's not even a question about that. But it's more about the manner in which he's been able to sustain that. I mean, he wins Brisbane, carries that form all the way to the semifinals, and I mean, let's be real. Nadal is playing lights out tennis, and Dimitrov just pushed him to five. But not just Dimitrov. I mean, you've also, you know, got Misha and his big upset of Djokovic, and I mean, there's just so many great results, so many interesting results. And I think honestly, like the increased speed of the surface has a lot to do with that.
Yeah, the court, especially the RLA court,
Rod Laver Arena for. Anybody
yeah.
Didn't pick that up.
They know. The RLA court is definitely faster than it was last year and in years past from what the guys all say.
Yeah, I mean, and a good bit faster too, it seems. Not even just a little bit.
Yeah, it's like it was noticeably. I mean, the first time we stepped out on it before the first round, both of the players were like, oh, okay, so it's quicker. That's good to know. That was clear. And the players are also saying that the balls are definitely quicker, and there's been no argumentation about that. It seems just a given, although just personally, I can't be sure about that because I don't remember. But the court, for sure, is faster.
Right. And you know, I think this is part of what plays into what we used to see at the Slams, which was just a greater variety of play styles having the opportunity to be successful with the slowing of the surfaces, the slowing of the balls over the last 15 years. You know, tennis has become much more homogenous. You know, it really has become kind of the baseline, slightly defensive with the ability to also carry offense has ruled the day for the last, you know, 10 years, give or take. And obviously Federer would be one of the more obvious exceptions. And Warwick has had some success with just a more overall aggressive baseline play, but he's also standing, you know, 10 feet behind the baseline, ripping backhands at 500 miles an hour. You know, it's not your typical aggressive play style where you're actually like playing with that intent to move forward. But point being, I think it's just that it's just been a grand slam where we've seen so much variety and so much opportunity, I think, for a variety of players to be successful. And that's what's made it so exciting.
Yeah, one of the things that I want to make clear, if we go back and you listen to, you know, some of the earlier episodes, these young guys are playing really well. Like, it's not that we have Federer and Nadal here into the final and everyone else has dropped their level.
Oh, no, of course, yeah.
Level is better than what it was 3 or 4 years ago. And somehow Fed and Nadal have just risen to either play better or play smarter or intimidate or whatever the heck they've done, and found themselves back in the final again. But the level of these young guys, I mean, like, man.
Right, I mean, you can run down the list. Zverev.
Zverev's level was super high. Monfils' level has never been as high as what it's been.
Right, Dimitrov,
and it's just
super
high. Dominic Thiem, like, people were watching him, and they couldn't figure out how anybody was even going to beat him.
Right.
And, you know, and here these guys, you know, I mean, it's not like they're falling to bad players, you know.
Sure.
But it's like every round, literally, the tennis is just getting better and better and better.
I would agree with that. So coming back to what I was, I guess, trying to say 5 minutes ago, we'll start with Federer Wawrinka. We've got a 3-hour, 5-set, relatively epic match. I mean, I don't think this is going to go down in tennis annals as, like, people, you know, I mean, like, we still talk about that Safin Federer match from 2005 at the Australian Open, that semifinal,
right.
Where Federer held match points and actually lost the match. That bloody tweener he tried to hit on match point. I still remember it. I still lose sleep
still
over that shot.
You.
Oh my god! But that aside, I mean, like, this is not a match that people are going to be talking about 10 years from now. But it was an incredibly high quality match.
I think so. The thing that really, really stands out to me about Stan right now is actually his consistency. Not. Mm-hmm. During points, but
no, just the consistency of results.
His consistency overall, like, I mean, he lost a 5-setter to Fed. While Fed's obviously playing well, I mean, Fed's beating everybody's faced. But like, Stan didn't seem to play. Like, it didn't seem like he had a great day. It didn't seem like
right.
he, you know, like, he's always kind of said, oh, you know, I'm not one of these great players, like. I can have a good tournament. I can have a good day.
Right.
You know, but
and now the belief is there. It's, you know, I mean, I think if we were going to put it in different terms, the Stanimal was not released in this match in the way that we've seen in some part. And, you know, some of the credit for that has to go to Federer, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But, you know, like to a degree, we can say that the Stanimal stayed in the cage. But despite that, Wawrinka still played a very high quality match that, I mean, I think he can be very proud of and would have beaten most anybody in the world on any other day.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's only three or four guys that were capable of winning that match, and obviously Fed was one of them.
Sure, sure. So let's talk about the match itself. You know, I think a great serving day for Wawrinka overall. I mean, 66% on first serves, and he bummed down 10 aces against Fed, which for Wawrinka is a pretty solid outcome, I think. Fed, meanwhile, didn't serve quite as well as he has been this tournament. First serve percentage was down a bit, certainly not at the epic 68% of a five sets that we saw earlier in the tournament when he played Nishikori. But, you know, three double faults for Fed over a five-set match, which is also actually quite a lot. We don't normally see more than maybe one from Fed in a match.
He doesn't double a lot. It seems like he served better for the first two sets and then,
right, and then dropped
sort
off
of
a little
dropped
bit.
Off a bit. Yeah.
And some of that might be related a little bit to whatever he had going on in his leg. Could also be a little bit of fatigue. I mean, it's getting a little bit later in the tournament. But whatever the cause, obviously, the serve wasn't quite as good, but still it wasn't a bad serving day. Slightly,
no.
I mean, his numbers are just slightly below his career averages, or certainly his averages over the last few years. On his first set percentage and his second set percentage. But, you know, that aside, I mean, I think one of the things that really stood out to me about this match was both their players' win percentage on second serves, which is, I mean, they both put up phenomenal numbers. Fed winning 58% of his second serve points, which is, I mean, that's very high, especially at this point in the tournament when you're typically playing against, you know, the stronger opponent to win that kind of percentage. But then Wawrinka, 70%. Win percent on his second serve.
No, wait. Just remind us, what was his win percentage on first serves?
63 on the first serve, and then 70 on the second.
A whole lot of sense.
Yeah, well, but I mean, I think there's a point to where this does make sense, though, because when you think about how Wawrinka likes to play and the fact that the courts were faster, you know, Wawrinka, when he's hitting that first serve, and this, I think, comes back to one of the things about what Fed tried to do this match and by and large did execute very well, was he really pressed the baseline. He did not give up real estate, looked to take time away from Wawrinka, looked to come in forward and shorten points. And I think these serving numbers for Wrenka play into that. So, you know, if Fed does take that return a little bit earlier and doesn't give Wawrinka that opportunity to really hit the kicker, step back, brace himself, and then, you know, really set up for that first shot, that first ball, and instead that the first two shots, it's a little more of a staccato rhythm. You know, it's serve, return, and then all of a sudden Wawrinka's playing that first shot. I don't think he's going to get the same quality of control over the ball in this particular match on this particular court that he would like. Whereas on the second, I don't think Fed was able to rush him as much.
Yeah, I just think that Stan spreads the court a little more intelligently on the second. And
you mean in terms of serve location or just first ball? Elaborate on that.
The combination of both of those. You know, he's much more likely to spread the service box and then mix up going behind Roger with going to the open court, using more angles. It's not so much hitting a heavier ball or, you know, even the speed of the ball that he's hitting, but more just about the intent even of things. I think that, you know, he pops that first serve pretty well, and traditionally Stan has liked to hit pretty much try and pound that first serve.
Oh, he just drives that thing. It's
just drives it in there.
Yeah, it's not a particularly, like, it doesn't have a ton of movement on it the way that we might see. I mean, like, if you look at Gasquet's first serve as an example. I mean, that thing moves 3 feet right to left as it comes over the net. But you know, Wawrinka's serve is just straight up power.
Yeah, and I mean, it's got spin on it, but it's pretty much a straight linear shot. And I just don't think it sets up the point as well for him, especially against. I mean, Roger is maybe. I don't, you know, people might not agree with this, but Roger, to me, is maybe the best returner of all time when it comes to somebody bombing in mostly flat serves.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think his ability once upon a time was almost surreal in that regard. These days, I don't know. I mean, I don't think he's doing it at the level that he used to, but he's always had that ability to blunt power on the return and just make a lot of returns in such a way as to get himself fairly neutral on the point. And we saw that repeatedly, especially during, you know, his prime, where he would face somebody who had been averaging, you know, 20, 30 aces a match, and then they play Federer and they serve 3 aces.
Right.
And, you know, he's always had that. And I think partly because he's been willing to just chip the return, block the return. And obviously the man has, you know, reflexes that are a little better than average. I think we could safely say that. I mean, the guy's got hands, and that's
his reflexes are super, super fast. And we don't think of him having a great backhand return, but you also have to realize that it's just so hard to ace him.
Right. His intent is different. Like, it's not. He doesn't return in the same way that, like, if you look at a Djokovic or an Agassi or a Murray, where they're really looking to be aggressive. He's always been happy just to start the point. And do so on as many points as possible. Those other guys are willing to take their chances a little bit and say, okay, I'm willing to make an error on this because for me overall, being a little more aggressive on the return, I'm going to make more mistakes, but I'm going to win more points. And for Fed, I think he's always believed if I can start a rally, I'm going to win the rally. And it's always been a mentality behind the way that he plays. And that's, I think, is going to have a huge impact on the final, which we'll get to in a little bit. But either way, I think also another standout stat from the match is Wawrinka's win percentage at the net, which 11 of 27 for 41%, not such a stellar number.
That's pretty far below the average on the tour.
Yes, yes.
The average on the tour being something like 60%.
Give or take, sure. And I mean, for a lot of guys that are coming forward, you know, under very careful circumstances. Guys like Misha, Zverev, notwithstanding. But, you know, I mean, like, Fed put up 68% on the match, for example. And I think we can say that Fed is, you know, clearly one of the best net players playing singles at the upper echelons of the game. But 41% is just poor by anybody's standards.
Yeah, well, the thing that really stands out with that is that Stan's not trying to get into the net.
Oh, no.
He's only coming forward off of short balls. He's coming forward off of a ball that he's basically wrecked.
Right.
Which means that he's getting out of position or Federer's coming up with some, you know, special kind of passing shot,
sure,
or he's just making an error.
Right. I mean, and Warrenk has always been a competent volleyer, but I don't know that we'd go a whole lot further than that. I mean, he's a good volleyer, I guess, but it's certainly not something that stands out as, man, that guy really knows how to volley. I mean, he's no Pat Rafter. He's no, I guess we could start saying he's no Misha Zverev. Is that
his
a thing
volleys
yet?
Are definitely
can
not
we
up
say that's
to
a thing now
Misha standards.
After one good tournament result? I don't know. But yeah, either way. But the other thing I think that really stands out as well is, I, you know, as much as we might talk about Federer's ability to blunt power on the first serve, we wouldn't consider either of these guys to be standout returners on the tour by today's standards. You know, if we look at receiving points won for both these guys, let's say over the last 5 years, neither of them are in the top five, top ten in those numbers.
Right.
And so I think we have to take that into account when we look at some of these statistics for the match as well. In just that, neither of them are traditionally, you know, great returners. Certainly on second serve, neither of them are players that we consider to be, you know, to win a really high percentage of those points. So in essence, you have, like, I think Federer, one of the best servers on tour, and Warrenk is obviously a very good server. So you've got two good servers playing against two, you know, not so great returners. So those numbers get bolstered a little bit. But let's talk a little bit about the patterns. I mean, I think the statistics are well and good, and people can stare at those all day. But let's talk a bit about how this match played out. And like I mentioned earlier, I mean, I think Fed really looked to hug the baseline to rub time away from Stan. And I think he played with a very clear intent to come forward.
Yeah, I think that Roger knows exactly how he wants to play Stan. And there was a sense in which he just wasn't bothered. Like you could sense he knows this guy's game.
Right.
He knows what's in his head. And he just, it was like, even watching it, it just felt like he knows that he's going to win this.
Well, this kind of, the thing I think is that there's no surprises. I mean, the guys have played a lot before. This is obviously not their first meeting. They've practiced a lot together before. They've played Davis Cup together before. There's just no surprises to be had here, you know. And I mean, especially with Warrenk, you know, I mean, he has obviously, I mean, the phenomenal backhand, a very good forehand, a good serve. He's a competent volleyer. But there's just, he doesn't have the tool set to come out and really shock anybody with what he brings to the table. It's more just a question of, you know, we know how Warrenk is going to play. It's how well is he going to hit the ball today? You know, is he going to go into just complete beast mode and just wreck the ball off the baseline or not? These are really the only questions that we have. Fed, I mean, has some more tools in the toolbox, and he does have the capability to come out and really mix it up a lot more and play perhaps potentially some surprising tennis.
Well, to be fair, Fed's got a bigger toolbox than maybe anybody.
Sure.
But, you know, I think that the approaches to the game, you know, you've nailed Stan's approach, which is I'm just going to go out and bang groundies. The thing that really stood out to me is that he did that really consistently.
Sure.
I mean, he didn't have a drop in his level throughout the match.
I mean, Fed was actually the one who had the drop in that third set.
Yeah.
I mean, he played a solid first service game and then just disappeared for the rest of the set.
I don't even know if we could say he disappeared. But as soon as his level dropped, I mean,
Stan,
just look at the
Stan
result.
Just kept going. I mean, obviously, you know, I think Stan played a very consistent, steady level through that match. You know, maybe a couple of hiccups leading to breaks. But generally speaking, I mean, we didn't see any sustained lull in his performance.
No, and if you look at the match overall, I mean, he's going to go back and review this match and review the stats, and he's going to say, okay, I won 2/3 of my serving points. A little weird that I won more second serve points than first serve points percentage-wise, but not that big of a deal. The numbers are right there for where he needs to be in order to hold serve most of the day. He won overall more receiving points than Fed.
Mm-hmm.
He hits less unforced errors. He
right.
hits almost the same number of winners.
Yeah.
And he loses.
Right. I mean, it's a good clean match. I mean, I think this really, we chalk this one up to me to just the difference in tactics. I mean, I think Fed just played the smarter match. And I think he was in the position to be just like, you know, in a lot of ways, Nadal is very well set up to play a very smart match against Federer. It's natural for him. I think Fed just played a tactically more astute match. He was able to go out there and make Wawrinka do things that he's not comfortable doing. And I think the big missing statistic here that we don't get to see is we look at the total points won for each player. We get the winners, we get the unforced errors. But what determines this match really is the forced errors that are a result of Federer moving forward so consistently and forcing Stan into making passing shots. I mean, Fed came in 50 times in the match. That's a lot of points. You know, he's in on you know, like 30% of the points in that match. It's a lot.
And that just makes Stan push a little bit more than he wants to, go a little closer to the line.
Yep.
You know, and at the same time, in a weird way, it makes him play a little bit more conservatively at other times. And both of those things play, you know, into Roger's hand.
Yeah, it just takes Wawrinka that little bit out of his comfort zone. I think Fed got to go out in the court and do things that he was perfectly comfortable doing. He didn't have to do anything exceptional or anything that he doesn't like to do. Whereas Wawrinka, I think, doesn't quite get to play that same match, and that's really what it came down to in the end, the difference.
Well, the one point that I would contend on that is that I think Fed hit over the backhand a little more than he likes to.
But that's been a consistent theme this tournament. He's hit over the backhand a lot and been quite aggressive in doing so.
Yeah, it's a necessary evil for him, I think.
I don't, you know, but look, let's talk about that for a second, because he's 6 months off from the game. I think it's obvious when we look at the way that he's playing tennis right now, he did not spend that 6 months chilling on a deck chair in Fiji. I mean, the man was doing some work, but he wasn't just doing some work to physically rehabilitate himself. I think he plainly went out and worked on his game. I think specifically he plainly went out and worked on his back end. He's hitting it in a way that I haven't seen him hit the Totsen back end in almost 10 years.
Well,
going back to when he used to just move a little bit better, and I think his movement still isn't quite at the level that it used to be, and probably never will be, to be honest. But he used to be able to hit better quality topspin backhand simply because of the quality of his movement. When he lost a half step, his ability to set up just wasn't quite there. And I wrote an article about that not very long ago with some of his matchups with Djokovic, how Djokovic earns that middle ball from Fed trying to hit over backhands that he shouldn't. But this tournament, even given the faster surface, like, he has been hitting that topspin backhand very, very well, and to a level that we haven't seen in years. And I don't think that it's a necessary evil for him right now. I think he's quite happy doing so. And I think that showed.
Yeah, and I, you know, the article's spot on if you haven't checked it out. I think part of the adjustment also, and we haven't actually talked about this, so I've got no idea if you agree with this, but I think part of the adjustment is actually still to his racket. I mean, he spent most of his career playing with a small head and moved up to the 97 over the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. And we saw him hitting the backhand differently, like you've described, and also hitting the forehand a little bit differently in this match. Early in the tournament, he was going pretty big and relatively flat, at least very linear for Roger.
Sure. Let's touch base on that very quickly, because when we talk about flat, we're not talking about a flat ball in terms of no spin, because these guys are hitting with such incredibly heavy topspin. We're talking about trajectory of ball. So maybe instead of using the word flat, we might use lower trajectory.
So he was
driving the ball a little more, still very heavy, but you know, a little bit lower on the net clearance, a little bit higher on the velocity earlier in the tournament.
Roger very rarely will hit a truly flat ball like, say, Tomas Berdych.
Right, because when he does, it's like 110 miles an hour. But yeah, continue.
Yeah. Yeah. Dimitrov is the same way. I mean, he'll hit his forehand 6 inches over the net. It's still got topspin on it.
Right.
But we saw Fed shaping the forehand a lot more, where he's hitting the, lo and behold, been a long time since we've brought up this article, the cross-court forehand that used to just absolutely dominate for him.
Sure.
Where, I mean, I can't remember the last time I saw him hit so many cross-court forehands in a match where he's just hitting a cross-court winner. And Stan was, every time, it was either a look of shock on his face or a look of just, well, I mean, that's just too good.
Well, maybe he's just sitting there wondering what year it is. You know, he's around the court, he's like, I thought it was 2017, but apparently it's 2005 again.
I mean, in 2005, Stan wasn't playing Roger in many matches.
Well, sure, because he was practicing with him and seeing that all the time.
Practice sets.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, I mean, we kind of, you know, it's obviously they did play a lot of practice sets back in the day. I mean, these we're talking about years when Federer literally was like mentoring Wawrinka, when he would take like these talented junior players from around Switzerland and practice with them almost as a favor. And he's obviously had a long history doing this, playing with college players for practices, hitting with juniors at tournaments. But I mean, like, really, there was a time when Wawrinka wasn't even at that conversation, where he was 50, 80, 100 in the world, and Fed would play practice matches with him. And now here they are. But I mean, you know, it's one of these things. The more things change, the more they remain the same. And yet again, Federer plays Wawrinka on a surface other than clay and wins. I mean, Wawrinka's only ever beat Fed twice, and both times on clay.
Which makes sense.
Well, of course it does. I mean, and that comes back to what we were talking about earlier about Fed's toolbox and his ability to shorten the point, rush Wawrinka, and make him play a little bit out of his comfort zone.
So how good right now does Federer's decision to take a few months off and try and get himself right look?
Well, it looks almost 18 Grand Slams good. is how I might phrase that.
Easy.
Well, I mean, I don't mean 18 more good, but it looks like it might be a decision that could get him to 18. And I mean, let's be real. If we start looking at Wimbledon, if they follow suit from the Australian Open and maybe speed the courts up a little bit, and it's grass, maybe even if they don't, this will probably not be Federer's only bite at the apple this year. He may or may not make more slam finals, but certainly we have to imagine, barring injury, that he is going to contend for more slams. He's going to be making more semis. He's going to be in the discussion, not just because, oh my God, the draw opened up for him, but, I mean, let's face it, he has not had an easy walk to this final, and yet he's handled every challenge with a plume. Now won 3 5-set matches on his way to the final, which is something that he's never done before in a single Grand Slam, has won 3 5-set matches.
Look at the guys he's beating.
Yeah.
I mean,
obviously, like I said, it's not been a cakewalk. This was no stroll in the woods.
I mean, you've got like Nishikori in round 4. He's never had to do that since he was like a junior.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, he's had some tough tournaments before. I think traditionally some quite tough tournament draws, but you know, not in the last few years, not like this, not where he's faced draws like this in the last five to eight years and actually come through all of those matches and ended up where he is.
Have you looked at where he's going to be ranked after this final?
You know, I haven't even thought about it, and that's actually a good question. I mean, you've got to imagine this brings him up top 10, but then again, does it? Because he did well at the Australian Open last year, if I remember correctly. Obviously not final, but...
I think right now... Live Tennis Rankings has him at 14.
Right, so he still doesn't even get top 10. He doesn't pick up that many points. If he wins, obviously that might bump that up a little bit. But
if he wins, he'd go into the top 10, it looks like, for sure.
Yeah.
But at least that gets him into the top 16. Because,
sure,
I mean, remember,
which is a big
he's
deal,
the 17th
into the Masters.
Seed.
Yeah, right.
Ends up with Nishikori in the fourth round.
Right, and if he doesn't, if he moved into like the Masters events moving forward, not ranked in the top 16, then potentially he's playing a Masters event not even seeded, which is just insanity.
Nobody wants to play him at Wimbledon this year.
Look, I mean, nobody wants to play him, period, except maybe Rafa. But even Rafa's got to...
Rafa will still play him in Paris.
Yeah. Well, Rafa wants to play almost anybody in Paris these days, or pretty much any day. Let's move on so we don't just make this the Federer Wawrinka podcast and talk about the other semi, which, I mean, when was the last time we could say both semifinals were of such an incredibly high quality? I don't know. It's been a while. I can't think of the last time that we saw tennis at this level on both sides of the draw into the semis and through the
especially
semis.
Especially the first two sets of both of those matches.
Unbelievable. I mean, well, I think this match, I think the second match we talk about, Nadal-Dimitrov, was the quality was so high just through the whole thing. Just very, very, very high quality matches. So let's talk about the match a little bit. I mean, when we look at the matchup, obviously Dimitrov has the stronger serve, and that played out. He hit 20 aces to Nadal's 8. A few more double faults than we might like for Dimitrov, but that's not really a surprising number over the course of 5 sets. He doesn't just have Federer's second serve, where it's, you know, such a rarity for him in a double. But I think that in the end, the double fault might be a huge story in the match just because of the timing in which he double faulted in that fifth set in his game to get broken. But, you know, outside of that, I mean, none of the numbers here are shocking, I don't think. Given the way that Dimitrov's been playing heading in, seeing him, I mean, really, he controlled this match in a sense. The outcome was on his racket. He hit 79 winners to Nadal's 45. He also made 70 unforced errors to Nadal's 43. You know, he came into the net almost 50 times, 48 times into the net to Nadal's 29. And I think let's just take a moment here and look at Nadal's net numbers. Because both players had phenomenally good days at the net. But Nadal came into the net on hard court 29 times.
Not bad.
That's, I mean, for him,
for a guy that's 3 meters back.
Well, but that's the thing. I think that when I look at these last few rounds, he's been playing tighter to the baseline and moving forward really and having the intent to move forward far more strongly than I think I've ever seen from him. You know, when I watched his quarterfinal, that was the first moment when I really thought, everybody better watch out. Like, uh-oh, this guy's come here. And he's actually, you know, I will be straight up front and admit that I thought 2.5 years ago, I said, I don't think Nadal, I think he will win maybe one more slam, maybe. And if he does, it will be at Roland Garros. And I didn't think he would ever win a slam on another surface again. Simply because, there was obviously a question about physically how well he could hold up. But secondly, given, you know, his history, I didn't think that he would ever make the adjustments that he actually really needed to make to compete at the hard court slams and the grass slams again in the modern game, like where we are today, and which were to step up closer to the baseline, to flatten out the forehand, to be willing to move forward in that, because he's always actually been surprisingly good at the net. He has his overhead is maybe second only to Federer's in terms of his ability to finish points.
Yeah, I mean, he came in 29 times. He only lost 4 points.
Well, that was the next part of that, was the 86%. But I'm just saying, but he's always actually, for a quote-unquote clay court specialist, even early on in his career, he's always actually been surprisingly competent. But for me, what I always thought that he had to do to really compete at the Sims was, like I said, to step up close to the baseline and flatten out the forehand and really look to move forward and end some points sooner. And lo and behold, here we are, 2017, Australian Open, Nadal's in the final, and he came to the net 29 times against Dimitrov, who was just crushing the ball, and yet Nadal still finding ways to get forward. And he wins 86% of the points up there, and he's playing exactly the way that I thought he would need to play. But to his credit, and obviously to my mistake, I did not think he was capable of mentally and emotionally making that adjustment to do, and he's done it.
And this is a point where, I mean, I have two guys that stand out on the tour to me as the guys who play outside their comfort zone the most and have been most dedicated about making changes to their game. One of them is Rafa, and the other one's Andy Murray.
Mm.
And, I mean, we've talked about this going back years, and, you know, Rafa is just what really impresses me about him is not his game so much as it is the fact that he wants to play a very particular way and that he consistently makes changes to that.
Yes and no, because I mean, I differ on you slightly on this in that when we look at 2010, when Rafa finally broke through at the US Open, we saw him do active work on his serve, and he upped his first serve velocity, lowered the percentage slightly. He flattened out the forehand some, to a degree, right? But he came out and actually hitting aggressive first serves, playing more aggressively off the baseline, won the U.S. Open for the first time, and then proceeded to go back to serving the way that he used to serve. You know, like, there's always been that touchstone that he might venture out of his comfort zone for a period, and even then, only a couple of times, I think, over the last 10 years. But he's always come back to this.
That's a good point.
Natural play.
That's a good point. But I think that Andy Murray has actually published some comments that are relevant here, which is, you know, Murray brought Yvonne Lendl onto the team, started winning slams. Lendl left. He brought some other people onto the team. And what he realized in that transition period before he's brought Lendl back is when he didn't have that guy in his camp, he was losing velocity consistently on his ground strokes.
Oh, wait, so we're talking about Murray and Lendl's relationship.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the reason
we're
talking
about Nadal for me.
So the reason that we're talking about it is because this happens a lot when you work on something with a player and they're working, what I'm going to say is against their comfort zone.
Right.
In Murray's case, it's hitting out on the forehand. In Rafa's case, it's also hitting out on the forehand.
But also the serve, I think, was the huge
the serve as well, which is what you brought up. The idea is he worked on the serve dedicatedly, won the U.S. Open, felt like, oh, man, that's great. I've done the work. Went back to his normal team. They stopped working on it as much, and he just fell into old habits. It's
right.
Not that he wasn't willing to do it as much as
Hang on a second. Hang on. I got to interrupt you there. When you say he fell into old habits and it's not that he wasn't willing to do it, let's look at the fact that they literally consulted with somebody in order to make those changes to the serve to get that specific outcome, got the outcome, and then immediately ceased working with that guy.
Yes.
I mean, that's a conscious change.
I think from the outside, it's easy to look at that and make improper judgments about it. I think from the inside of the camp, what's happening is pretty simple. It's simply an underappreciation for the amount of work that it takes to maintain those changes. I literally think that they thought, okay, we worked our ass off on this for 6 months. We've done what needed to be done, and that, you know, we can just go forward and it's going to stay there. I don't think that they realized, you know, what we probably need to do is keep this person around for 2 years and we need to work on it for 10 minutes a day.
Right. But you know, I think also a part of that bleeds into that is kind of that almost clan mentality that Nadal's always had around himself with, you know, he and Uncle Tony, like they just had that very kind of closed off. You know, I think it was such a big deal for them to bring somebody external in, even for just that one specific purpose of working on the serve. And it's like the moment that they felt like, okay, we got what we needed out of that. Let's get back to our core. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, I get the implications. I think that they're strange in – not in a bad way, but they're strange, I think, actually in a good way, in that they're actually – I mean, they're a very tight-knit group, but at the same time, they're very open. Like, you can walk up to them and just talk to them, which is not the case with everyone's family, everyone's traveling group. And, you know, the real difference is I think that Tony solicited a lot of opinions from a lot of people, and I think that Rafa gets thrown a lot of opinions at him, whether he solicits them or not. And there, you know, I don't think really that there were that many people that really were good enough to help Rafa serve better without having consequences, you know, without actually having him have to slide back. And
right.
I don't think that Uncle Tony, you know, in a real way, I mean, there's only so many people that they were going to trust. I don't think that, you know, I think there's probably more coaches out there that actually could have helped Rafa than actually got to talk to him.
Of course.
But, you know, that's the way of the world. And, you know, I just don't think that it was a closed-mindedness or a decision on their part that said, you know, well, we don't need this anymore.
I disagree with you on that. I mean, I remember reading or hearing comments from the coach that they worked with on that, and he felt very much like he had just been dismissed. You know, like that was it. He did this work and then it was like almost like he didn't exist anymore. Like he didn't really get a lot of credit for the work that he did. It was very much like a kind of a behind closed doors project. And you know, that was the moment the work was done. They just, you know, he got kind of shuttled off to the side. You know, and it's not like they don't have the resources. It's not like this guy wouldn't be willing to continue doing that work. To me, it was just a conscious decision to basically reduce back to their comfort zone in terms of the personnel. And, you know, I think we saw consequences on that. But we can talk about the Nadal serve all day. but we still have a match to discuss, and actually, and a final to talk about too. So let's get back to Grigor and the DAO real quick. First of all, I mean, hats off to Grigor. I think he's well and truly arrived in his final form, so to speak, in terms of, you know, his performance, not just here in Brisbane. He has played with a discipline, an emotional stability that we've... I mean, this guy stood in the hallway after the match, and the look on his face was not that of a man who was crushed and didn't believe. This was a man who looked like, I belonged out there, I believe I could have won this match, almost I should have won this match, and I'm, by God, I'm going to be there again, and I'm going to get it next time. He looked determined.
What do you think he needs to do to win, say, the next one?
Convert that one of the two break points he had in that fifth set. I mean, let's be real. Like I said, I think Nadal is playing lights-out tennis, and in some regards, the best tennis I've ever seen from him, in some regards. And that he was a point, probably, from winning that match says so much about what Dimitrov has done. I'm not sure there's a lot that he needs to change right now. I mean, he's serving very well. He's defending well. He's playing with a structure. There's just a sense of purpose about him that we've never seen before. I think he has the great coaching staff in his corner, and we're seeing the dividends of that. And credit to Dimitrov for actually getting the right coaches and staying with the right coaches. But what we didn't see in the past was him actually adjust his tactics and his strategies depending on who he was playing. And we've seen that over the last multiple weeks now, where he plays a different match depending on who he's out in the court with. Sometimes there's subtle variations, and when he has the tools to just go out there and hit through somebody, he goes out and hits through them. You know, when he needs to make some adjustments in terms of where he's directing play, he's doing that. We've seen some matches where he's come forward a lot more, some matches where he's come forward a little less. He's making these match-to-match adjustments to specific opponents. I don't think a lot has to change. Some of it's just experience. His second Grand Slam semi ever. The last one was at Wimbledon. He was almost a little bit fortunate to be there. It was that sense of, wow, I just had a really good tournament.
Right.
You know, whereas this was, I've done the
work.
Which
I think is what actually happened.
Yeah, but this time I think he's actually earned it. Like, he didn't play well in multiple matches getting to where he's gotten this tournament. You know, I mean, he had some mild struggles early on.
Yeah.
But... There was that shades of what we've seen from the Big Four of Los Angeles, where they go out and even when they don't play particularly well, they win anyway. I mean, he dropped it. You know, he had a tiebreaker set with O'Connell in his first round. He dropped a set to Chung, which, I mean, we talked about that a little bit. Like, just tall Gasquet, you know, dropped a set to Istomin, who didn't have his legs fully under him after, you know, after the match that he had with Djokovic, and then the following...
Istomin was cooked.
You know, and Dimitrov didn't play all that well, and then he comes out and just destroys Goffin, and then plays the match he does against Nadal. Like, he hasn't come out and just played lights out tennis this entire tournament. He's just handled people in the way that they needed to be handled, even when he wasn't playing particularly well. So this is where
we see things a little bit differently. I don't see him as making a lot of adjustments from match to match. In my mind, he's doubled down on his best qualities. And this is what I think the coaching staff on his team, I mean, this is what I give them credit for, is they've gotten him to really buy in and understand, okay, what do I have? I can hit the ball really hard. I can hit first serves really hard and pretty flat. I can hit my spots better than most with those. And I'm one of the most athletic guys on the tour.
His athleticism is severely underrated. I think he is incredibly athletic. I don't think people really understand the degree to which he is athletic.
When we talk about the athletic players on tour,
everybody talks... Well, I mean, I think he has, to some degree, he's always been a very galvanizing, exciting player to watch. But, you know, when we talk about the most athletic people on tour, I think a lot of people would talk about... Obviously, Monfils is probably the first name that comes on everybody's lips. You know, and they talk about probably Murray and Djokovic and Nadal and Federer. And I think that Dimitrov easily belongs in that group, and actually probably, in terms of pure athleticism, surpasses most of them. The difference is, mentally, he's just never played with the kind of structure like you're talking about. But, you know, just to touch on that quickly, I don't think we disagree in that he knows what he's doing well, and his team's going to understand what he's doing well. He is playing with more structure. He's using those tools more intelligently. But what I did say was that he's adapted to opponents when he's needed to. when he's had the ability to come out and blow people off the court, he's just come out and hit through people. But when, like what we saw in Brisbane, when he played Raonic, he played in a way that reflected that he understood he wasn't the biggest hitter on that court. That he understood he wasn't going to be in control all the time, that he understood he needed to absorb pressure from Raonic and extend points and then find ways and look for opportunities. And then in the very next match, we saw him come out and return to, you know, dictating play, controlling the point, and you know, he got the results when he beat Nishikori. And I think most people, Dimitrov is able to come out and out-hit because he is so athletic, because he has a huge forehand, and I think one of the most underrated backhands in the game right now. In terms of his tops and back, and I think it's phenomenal. I think that he's going to belong, maybe not quite at the same level as Wawrinka in the long run, but we need to start talking about him in somewhat similar terms. His ability to hit off that side is phenomenal. He can hit with power, spin. He's got it all. I think some of it comes down to the decision making that's going to get better and better as time progresses, but there's just nothing wrong with that stroke.
Yeah, I mean, if you go reach way back to when Grigor was 18 and working with Peter Lundgren, you know, Peter Lundgren worked with Federer around that age as well, and he told people flat out, you know, this guy has more tools than what Federer had and is just better at the same age. And that wasn't, I mean, he wasn't blowing smoke. I think
in terms of I think he does have a better top spin backhand than Federer. Even in Federer's prime, I think that the differences are subtle because Federer's always had a grace, and I don't mean that in terms of obviously I think his game's always been a little more aesthetically pleasing than Dimitrov's, but there's always been just that little bit of refinement in Federer's movement where his spacing's always been a little bit better, his efficiency's been a little bit better. He might get there and take one less step than Dimitrov and end up in perfect position. And Dimitrov will take an extra step, but end up slightly, you know, like 2 or 3 inches out. And that's something I think Federer's always had at a degree that we've never seen from anybody in the sport before, is the precision of movement, his ability to judge distances and just stop at exactly the right place in the court is at a level we've never seen before. And also I think Federer came into his own in terms of his patterns and his understanding of play and how to construct his points much earlier than Dimitrov did.
Yeah.
But also to be fair to Dimitrov, Fed got to do so without having, you know, the big four at the top of the game when he did it, which helps, you know. I mean, I think it's a little easier to make some deep runs in tournaments and get more matches under your belt. I'd be curious to see when we compare them age to age, like how many professional, like ATP level matches each of them had played at, let's say, 21 or 22. Because I just feel like Federer's probably had more matches under his belt at that age.
I think you're probably right, and you know,
because the draws were, you know, you were less likely to run into somebody that was almost guaranteed to beat you.
And Grigor's a lot, like, he's a confident guy. You get the sense that if he can get a handful of big matches that he wins under his belt, that it's going to be hard to stop him.
Yes. I mean, I think, like I said, I think he's well and truly arrived. The way that he handled himself in defeat just spoke volumes to me. This is not a flash in a pan. He is well and truly here, and he is here to stay. I think you are looking at a future world number one. You're looking at a future multiple-time Grand Slam winner, and, you know, I'm excited to be able to say that because I like the way that he plays tennis.
A future world number one.
I don't know that he's going to spend 5 years up at number one, but I think he's going to reach number one before he retires.
But just to get there, because the guys that are coming through...
Oh, I know, and I say that knowing who's coming through. But look at the completeness of his game and all the tools that he has. And now, not just that, because, I mean, look, if you look at somebody like Safin, obviously just having completeness of game doesn't, you know, guarantee you a ton of Grand Slams. You could have every tool in the book if you don't go out there and play smart tennis. We've seen people that have reached number one in the world and won multiple Grand Slams without all those tools because of the mental aspect of the game. Just as we've seen people with all of the tools that we could possibly want never really reach their potential because they lack the mental side. I think Grigor's finally started to put all those pieces together. I think he will reach number one. I think he's going to be battling with, you know, your TMs and your Zverevs over the next 10 years for those slam titles. But let's be real. You know, as much as I love this tournament and that we have Fidal in the final, you know, Federer's not going to be in Grand Slam finals 5 years from now. Nadal is not going to be in Grand Slam finals 5 years from now. I'm not sure. Djokovic.
Wait. What? How can you just write off Nadal like that?
I just do. I'm sorry. I don't think he has 5 years of tennis left in him at the professional level, at the level that we're looking at right now. I do not think he's ever. He just look at the injury history. I don't think that he just has the longevity that Federer does. I don't think you're going to find a lot of people that are going to disagree with me on this one.
I mean, yeah, people were saying Nadal wasn't going to make it until he was 27, and here he is at 30.
But that was hyperbole. Let's be real. That was people just being a little bit ridiculous.
No, I don't think it was hyperbole. That's what people actually believed. And look, come on. If 3 years ago, if I had told you, hey, he's 30 years old, he's going to be in the Aussie final, you would have said, no, man, he's done. I mean, we started out the podcast that way.
Right. No, I agree on that. But that's because I didn't think that, like, mentally and emotionally, he was capable of making the adjustments he needed to make. But he's made those adjustments, and I think that is going to extend his career. I think he's going to be competitive at the top level for another couple of years because he's been willing to make those adjustments. And that is assuming that he doesn't revert back to the way that he used to play. I think if he reverts back to old Nadal, he's done. But if he
he's not gonna have five more years where he plays 20 tournaments a year. Okay, I will grant you that. But I think, just like what we've seen with Roger, he can take some time away from the game. He doesn't have to play as much. He certainly doesn't need the money. The tournaments certainly are going to still want him. All the players still want him around because he's still playing the best tennis, and we want the best competition. I mean, there's no reason to me to think that he can't do it for the next 3, 4, 5 years, unless you just want to blanketly say he's going to get hurt and he's not going to hold up.
I think regardless of whether or not he gets hurt, I think we're looking at another – if he maintains the current style of play, you're looking at a couple years of him being up at the top of the game, still competing for slams, and that's if he maintains the changes that he's made. And I think he's going to either just say no mas, or he's going to just slowly kind of fade away. I think we're going to see a similar – eventually. Obviously, he's a much higher caliber player than Ferrer, but you've seen what's happened to Ferrer over the last couple of years. I mean, he's just slowly slid out of contention. Not that he was ever really contending for slams, but he was consistently making quarters, sometimes semi. But we've just seen that level drop, that one step lost that at this level makes the world of difference. I don't think we're seeing, regardless of what he does tactically, we're not seeing Nadal in slam finals in 3 years, in 4 years, in 5 years. But point being, that, and obviously you disagree with me, and that's fine. But regardless, I think Dimitrov will be competing for those slam titles with these other guys. I think that Djokovic is not the player that he was 2 years ago, and I'm not sure that we'll ever quite see. And unless he makes, I think, some changes to his setup and the way he's doing things, that we're not going to see him dominate the way that he has. I think the door is well and truly wide open, and this is maybe the most exciting moment, the most exciting time that we've potentially ever had in men's professional tennis right now.
So what's going to be the first slam that Gregor wins?
That's going to come down a little bit to just luck of the draw. I think I just said this is maybe the most exciting time that we've ever had in men's professional tennis, is because I think if you look over the next 3 years, we're going to walk into every slam and we're going to have 8 guys that legitimately have a shot to win them.
Mm.
Whereas for the last 12 years, we've had basically between 2 and 4 people that have had legitimate shots. And obviously we've had our outliers. We've had our, Cilic picked off his one slam. We've had a couple people sneak one here and there. But the reality was that those were really a little bit lucky, I think. No disrespect to Cilic, but I mean, that draw, just everything fell into his lap when he
finished. Well, Cilic played great. He has not played at that level since then.
Well, because I don't think he can. And this is the difference: Cilic cannot come out consistently play at that level, tournament in, tournament out. He can't even play a whole tournament at that level, except maybe once in every 4 or 5 years.
Right.
As what we've seen.
If he does that again, he'll win the tournament.
Well, he might. He might
he just
win
might
the tournament.
Never do it again.
Well, he might never. But the thing to me is, even if he plays like that, he might win the tournament. But when he did play like that, that draw opened up for him. I mean, his first ever slam final in the meat of the era of the Big Four was not against Djokovic. It wasn't against Murray. It wasn't against Federer. It wasn't against Nadal. It was against Nishikori. And
Nishikori was extremely tight in that match.
And also, I don't think Nishikori was physically, where he needed to be to make that genuinely competitive at the end of the day.
Yeah. I honestly
And
think that he
even
was.
like when you look at the matches like Chile had in the semis against, that was an exhausted Fed. The man could barely run. Like it was not a real match, and we saw that. I mean, Fed was a full step behind his normal speed at that time. I mean, the match Fed played before that five set had just crushed him. But here we go diverging again. I think maybe it's time we talk about the final.
Why? Why would we talk about a Rafa Federer final? I don't understand.
I know, right? What's compelling about that? Because, that's not exciting at all.
All right, so let's just right into it. Who you got? Who are you picking?
Oh, gee. Look, let's cover one thing up front. I think anybody who talks about match outcomes, especially matches like this, in terms of certainty, they're crazy. You just can't. And look, I would just point to this tournament alone as to why. We've got Zverev beating Murray. We've got Isterman beating Djokovic. There's no guarantees in tennis. What we can talk about is patterns, we can talk about matchups, and we can talk about probabilities. And when we look at that, I'm really torn. I'm really, really torn about this one. I think so much of it just comes down to how well Federer serves. Because if he does not have control of the point, he's going to lose the majority of those points when he's not ahead. If the points are long, Fed's losing them. It's just that simple. When the points are short, Fed's going to win a lot of those short points, but not all of them, because sometimes the point's going to be short because Nadal's in control and just hitting that forehand winner very early on. So it really, the outcome of the match to me just comes down to Federer's serving. If he has a great serving day and he comes out and he serves in the high 60s the way that he did against Nishikori, I think he's going to take the match. The court surface is fast. He's playing with a conviction and a commitment to the style of tennis that he wants to play, which involves moving forward, which involves shortening points. He's attacking second serves in a way we haven't seen maybe ever. I don't know, in terms of like the consistency. He's always taken a cut at second serves here and there, but this is the first time I think I've seen him consistently just step in, take the ball early, drive backhands, and look to get on top of the point right at the
Yeah,
beginning.
he's doing it
And
more often.
that is the one thing, when we look back historically, the one thing that he's always failed to do against Nadal. He's always returned with a level of fear. I don't know I just feel like he's always lacked the courage to take his chances, and played right into Nadal's hands in doing so. Because as I mentioned earlier, I think Fed's always felt against almost anybody in the history of the sport, if he gets in a rally, he's going to win the rally. Maybe not every time, but his odds are great. Nadal is the one player for whom that isn't really true. Nadal is the one player for whom
He
when Fed.
certainly doesn't feel that way.
No, well, I mean, I think,
He.
look, it's not just that he doesn't feel that way. The statistics bear that out. When we look at the longer, any kind of established baseline rally where, neither player has like an early short ball or clear dominance and control of the point, Federer loses the vast majority of those points, right? The longer the rally goes, the more likely we're going to end up with Federer hanging a backhand in the middle of the court and Nadal finishing. That's
Well,
just the
and
reality of it.
to me, that just speaks to the fact that Federer's constructing points in specific ways, and if he hasn't gained a significant advantage a few shots in, then either you've done something great or he's kind of not himself.
Well, I think there's a combination. Honestly, I think there's a combination of factors with that when it comes to Nadal. I think that Federer has always played in a fearful state when it comes. I think right from the very first meeting professionally, Nadal got in Federer's head. He spooked him, and look, Federer has beaten Nadal obviously more than once. He has bageled Nadal multiple times. It's not like the guy doesn't believe he can win, but there is an element of fear when he faces him that I don't think he fears. He feels against any other player that he's ever faced, and
Does he believe he can win in a Grand Slam final?
I think he believes he can win. The question to me is he going to have the courage to go out and play the way that he needs to play from start to finish in order to do so? Because the last time that he played Djokovic in a Grand Slam final, he didn't have that courage. He played an entire tournament crashing the net, moving forward, playing hyper-aggressive tennis, was very successful doing so, had beaten Djokovic doing that exact same strategy earlier in that, like just a few weeks before. I think it was at Cincinnati, he beat Djokovic in straight sets, and then gets to the slam final on the same surface against Djokovic and chickened out.
Oh, well, those are strong words.
They are strong words, but it's true. He didn't commit to coming forward the way that he had for months leading into that match, and he stopped himself. He didn't have the courage to finish it out, and
you know,
lost
the
match.
I want to interrupt you there because I can just imagine the swarms of people about Federer chickening out.
Look, I mean, but the reality is I think a lot of people are going to agree with that. I mean, I think, and regardless of whether I do, I still think it's true. He did. And I think we've seen the same pattern with him against Nadal, where he's always just seemed loath to take his chances.
Look,
you know?
this is all that I want to point out, right, is that tennis players are very conservative people in a lot of ways because – you know, if you make an error, you lose a point right away. And the guys at the upper echelon of the game, they're conservative. That's just the way it is.
Well, let's be real. Federer, but the margins at the top of the game are so small. The reason these guys dominate, there are so many players out there who have tools. The reason these guys are able to dominate is because they are smart enough to manage those fine margins.
Yeah.
Right? To realize, you know what, I've just cut down those five errors a set and I'm going to win this match.
I'm just saying that you and I both know what Federer would do if he just sort of let it all hang out and went for it.
Well, I mean, look at the way he practiced. I mean, when you've seen him practice and the pressure's off. I mean, he does things on a tennis court that
in practice that you would never see in a match.
That you never see from anybody, like in the history of the sport. It's ridiculous what he can
do.
Just
can't. I mean, yeah, exactly. So what I'm saying is just that I think that in a very real sense, what you described about Federer is accurate. I just want to make it clear that he doesn't see it that way and that it's perfectly reasonable for him not to see it that way.
Sure.
Because he probably thinks that he made a calculated decision against Djokovic. And in some sense, I mean, I wish that you had a voice in that camp where you could say, look, if you don't keep doing what has been working for you for the last 3 months, then you're chickening out, and there's no other way to think about that.
Right.
And that would have made a different decision. He would have approached it differently. But, I mean, let's be real. Nobody is saying that to Roger Federer.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, there's a point where you gotta wonder who would have the courage to, and then having said that, to what degree is Federer going to say, look, that's nice. I've got 17 Grand Slams, which is more than anybody's ever won in the history of this sport on the men's side, doing what I've been doing till now. And, you know, to put it in Kanye's state, you know, it's great. I'm going to let you finish, but, you know, there's that point where you wonder, like, was he just going to fall back on? And that's really what it comes down to me is in the big moments, on the big stage, in the last 8 years, let's just say 8-9 years, we've consistently seen Federer fall back to his comfort zone in Grand Slam finals and often do so. And look, when his comfort zone has been the right matchup, like when we've seen against Murray at Wimbledon, we've seen it happen where the matchup has been the right one, where his comfort zone is such that it's going to get the job done. He wins, but when it's not, he loses. And we've seen that recently against Djokovic. We've seen that in his whole career against Nadal. Nadal is the one player that he really cannot play his comfort zone tennis with and still win and be competitive even. Like really, and I should add too, if he comes out and serves well and attacks the second serve, I think Federer wins this match.
So to me, this is an emotional battle. I mean, we could go through the tactics for hours because we have, but I just don't. There's only two ways that I see this match going. Okay. One is Rafa beats Fed again in a hardcore slam final or any slam final that's not Wimbledon. And he does it, you know, because of the matchup, because of the mental side, because Fed has some trepidation and doesn't commit to his game. Blah, 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 whatever. The one thing that I can be sure of, I think, is that Rafa will come out like an absolute bulldog in this match and stay that way. There is no way he's going down. He has so much confidence. Like, he wants to play Fed in a final because he believes I can just outwork this guy. If I just leave it on the line, I can take tennis off for the next 3 months, but I'm going to close the gap. And I'm going to you know, continue to cement my legacy. And he's still playing for legacy. Like, sure. Don't fool yourself. So that being said,
I thought he was playing for gas money at this point. No.
Yes. Yeah, for his yacht, which he probably doesn't even have a yacht because that's the way the guy is. But
it would
who
be
knows?
Distracting.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So that being said, he's either going to go out and just win this match, or this is going to go down as even better than the Wimbledon matches they've had and immediately be in the conversation for best matches of all time.
Well, I think it certainly has the potential to do that. And, you know, one of the things that I mean, I look at the great 2009 final with that epic facet. You know, one of the frustrations, I think, things that's always going to mar that match is the darkness that they finished under. You know, like, this has the potential with a relatively neutral, slightly fast hard court to be an incredibly entertaining spectacle that features two amazing athletes with an incredible legacy behind them, both individually and together. I think this has the potential to be one of the best matches in the history of men's open tennis. The pieces are there. The drama's there. It really just, to me, comes down to whether or not Fed is going to fill his end of the bargain. We know Nadal's going to do his job. The man's done nothing but do his job from the moment he hit the Pro Tour. There's no question about whether or not he's going to do his part of it. The question is whether or not Federer is going to do his part. And I will say this, like, for Federer is also obviously still playing for legacy. I mean, there's a love of the game. And that's clear through everything the man says, through his actions. There's a deep and abiding love of the game. But let's be real. For all that we see that nice side of Federer, we see him down in Africa working with orphans and, you know, all the videos.
He's just a nice guy.
He's a super nice guy, but let's be real. This man wants to win this match. This man is hungry to dominate. There is a killer instinct inside of Federer that we don't often see, and we only see glimpses of.
I think that's going to be a problem.
But I think
that will be the nail in his coffin.
Well, that's the thing, though. But here's I mean, I think there's an element where Federer has always been a little bit too worried about his public persona legacy. In terms of, there's a part of Federer that, I mean, and look, most everybody likes to be liked. There's a part of Federer that I think he likes to be liked a little bit too much. And he's always been a little bit too worried about, you know, his public perception. And it would be nice to see him unleash that inner animal a little bit. Just a little bit. I'm not talking about him going out there and swearing and throwing rackets and cracking stuff. But to see a little bit of what we saw earlier on in his career before he became the true statesman that he did evolve to become, that true ambassador for the sport. Very early on, you know, like that 2004, 2005, he was still a nice guy. But when he walked out on the court, there was just a ruthlessness to the way he went about dismantling everybody that faded over time. And I'd love to see that Darth Federer show up again, where he just comes out and the stone-faced killer, you know?
Look, I would love to see that too. I think that along with that goes a particular focus on himself and on execution.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in this match, for Roger, there's so much riding on it in a weird way, even though he's the guy that's in the lead as far as all the numbers go, besides head-to-head. You know, if Roger wins this match, he goes to 18 Grand Slam victories, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that probably most people would say, okay, Rafa's never going to catch him. Where is he going to get four, you know?
Sure.
Whereas if Rafa wins this match, all of a sudden the race is on.
I know, it's too...
He could get two more to tie him just at the French, you know?
It's possible.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not a given, but, I mean, you better believe nobody's going to want to play Rafa in Paris this year, no matter what.
Look,
I mean, he's pushed himself now. With Novak slipping down,
right,
Rafa has pushed himself back to the favorite in Paris.
That door is open for sure. And, I mean, like, Rafa could be 80 years old in a wheelchair. I still wouldn't play him Roland Garros center court.
He might, you know, I don't know. I've finally started watching some of those wheelchair guys, and I mean, they're pretty good, but I would think that Rafa would probably still be better. But look, the point being, Fed actually has a lot to lose from his perspective.
Yes.
He's got a guy on his heels, And I think there's a certain amount of trepidation going into this.
And there always
and
has
Rafa
been.
Has everything to gain because, you know, I've always...
Well, yes and no. But, I mean, look, let's be real. Rafa has a lot to lose too. Because if that gap does widen tomorrow, I think the odds of him closing those four slams is exceedingly low. But here's the difference to me is I do believe Rafa has a lot to lose. I don't think Rafa thinks he has a lot to lose. That was the final point that I was going to make is this. It all comes down to perception, right? Rafa walks out in the court and we know he's not even thinking about what he has to lose. He's hungry for the win. And that's all that he wants. And that's why I say I know he's going to hold up his end of the bargain.
And can you say that about Roger Federer right now?
I don't know. Well, this is a big ask. I don't know. This is a different space. We've never, you know, this isn't Roger Federer from 2013. This isn't Roger Federer from 2015 or 2009 or 2004. This is a guy 6 months off from the sport. We know he's hungry. We know he's always been hungry. You don't do the work. I mean, the guy's got to be worth, you know, $400-500 million at this point. You don't do that work and come back from that injury and you know, do all everything that he's done if you're not hungry. Like I said, you don't get to where he's gotten if you don't have that killer instinct inside you. It's just not possible. He's just done such a good job and sometimes too good of a job of hiding it from the world. And the question is whether or not he's going to let it come out a little bit tomorrow, whether we're going to see that. There's a flip side where I think it's all a matter of perception. I'm not sure whether or not Roger thinks about it as having something to lose at this point. Did he have the expectations to come out and make the slam final? I don't know. I don't, you know, short of asking the guy. There's a part where I think he always believes. But even then, like, you just wonder, even if he did or he didn't, you don't know. Like, you're going to ask him in a press conference, and you're going to get a great answer, and it's going to be a very nice answer. Is it going to be the real answer? And I don't mean to suggest that Federer is a fake person, you know, not by any stretch of imagination.
No, it's just nobody's going to pour their heart out every news.
Exactly.
No, actually, I take that back. There's one guy who does that. His name's Nick Kyrgios.
Okay, fair enough.
And we do not treat him nicely.
No, that's
for the record.
Yeah, that's also true.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but to me, this is really simple. I think that we can say that Federer believed that he was going to make this final. Now, would you agree with him? Do you think that he was right to believe that? Who knows? That's a different conversation. But for this guy to take 6 months off and just work on his game, he's thinking to himself, you guys don't know what's coming. Because he hasn't been able to work on his game. I mean, the guy's so good with media. He's so good with UNICEF. He's so good with all of his commitments to the world at large.
Right.
That 6 months off, he's gotten in more training in the last 6 months than he probably has in the last 3 years.
Even including his rehab from the injury. Like, even you take that period out of the picture, I mean, it's obvious he's done technical work. I mean, he's serving, I think, the best we've ever seen from him. His net game is incredibly sharp. He's hitting his backhand better than there. He's hitting his forehand better than he has in probably 8 years.
And he has commitment about what he's trying to do. And so I think that, you know, he knew that stuff. I mean, the players talk about it all the time, about not getting enough time to train. Like, that's what all the calendar conversations are about. The level of tennis would go up if we had half as much tennis on the calendar.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that that's really what's best for the ATP and that that's what's best for, the tennis world.
Sure.
So, you know, Fed's not surprised to be here. I think the surprise for him is that Rafa's on the other side.
Right, and I think it's such a surprise. I mean, it's got to be a level of disappointment.
Huge.
And there's no way around that. But then again, I think there's also a part of Federer that wants it to be Rafa. Deep down inside, there's a part of him. He's always talked about wanting the challenge, about wanting to beat the best players on the biggest stage. And it doesn't get bigger than this, and it doesn't get better than this. You're talking about the two greatest players in the history of the men's sport. And they're here facing off in the Aussie Open final. It's crunch time, Jacob. Who do you pick, and how many sets is it going to take?
I say Rafa in four. And so, I'm going to say you're going to see it, because when push comes to shove and Federer has his opportunities, the question is going to be, does he come in and approach the net on Rafa's backhand consistently? And I just think he's just not going to do it.
Right.
I think he's going to hang back on the baseline. And it's going to cost him the match.
Okay. I say Fed in four.
It's a gutsy call on your part.
It is a gutsy call. I will freely admit there's an emotional component to that. Part of it's just the desire to see him win number 18. Like I said, I know Nadal's going to do his part. There's never been any question on my part of whether he's the greatest competitor that we've seen mentally and emotionally. There's no question whether or not he's going to bring it tomorrow. But I think that we are going to see a Federer who's going to play like he has nothing to lose. And we haven't seen that in a long time, and I think that's going to be the difference. We've seen what when Fed comes out on slightly faster courts and attacks, he has bageled Nadal on the big stage before at the World Tour Final. I mean, like, he has destroyed the man at times, and I think we're going to see a taste of that tomorrow. Obviously not for the whole match. I think Nadal will peg a set, but right or wrong, I just believe that Fed's going to take this one, and it's going to be a very entertaining spectacle regardless. For people who have questions, comments, you can reach me at glenn@tactical.tennis, jacob@tactical.tennis,
That's right.
the website at tacticaltennis.com. And also you can follow us on Facebook, and that's all I have.
Yeah. Right, I think if you're a Roger Federer fan, pray for rain.
Well, that too. I think if it rains and the roof closes, everything changes. But on that note, people, get comfy, get your popcorn, and buckle your seatbelt, because it's going to be
set
one heck
of
a ride.
Set your alarm clock. Wake up at 3:46 in the morning.
Yes, and we will see you all after a new Australian Open champion has been crowned.
Enjoy.